This is Cosmos Magazine from Autumn. That's Australian Autumn 2018, issue 78. And this is Peter Hill Explains, where I'm just improving my speaking skills as part of cardiac rehabilitation. Without further ado, I'll read just one article which has come up, opened up the magazine. It's called Hacking Human Performance. Athletes looking for winning edge must master the space between their ears. Rick Luffett investigates where the real field experiments in sports psychology are happening. Here's a enter, a sort of a header piece for it. It's Kate Campbell called it possibly the greatest choke in Olympic history. The swimmer was speaking of her sixth place at the 2016 Rio Olympics in the 100-meter freestyle, the event for which she held the world record. But she might as well have been speaking for the Australian swimming team as a whole. So we got licked at 2016 Olympics. Coverage never tells you that. Okay. Predicted to take as many as 11 gold medals in Rio, the team managed just 3 and was reduced to watching the Americans win 16 in the 32 events. Many without Australians even in the top 3. It was the second Olympiad in a row which the highly touted Australian team had came up short. A terrible fate for the nation that invested heavily in swimming successes and where, as John Bertrand, president of the Swimming Australia, puts it, swimming is part of our DNA. There are several possible reasons. Perhaps some swimmers underestimated the 11-hour jet lag. Perhaps training errors caused the team to peak too soon. They performed very well in the month prior, said Andy Walsh, the Australian-born sports scientist and consultant now based in Southern California. Perhaps many of them just happened to have bad days at the same time. Whatever the cause, Bertrand's mission to make sure Rio disaster doesn't happen again at the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo. To do this, he is focusing on what he sees as the sports science final frontier, the mind. We think the biggest gains are between the ears, he says. Science has become an integral player in improving sports performance over the past century. It began with German psychologist and physiologist August Kroch pioneered work on respiration and circulation, which contributed hugely to the development of exercise physiology. He won the Nobel Prize in 1920. He continued with Danish exercise physiologist Erik Houwe Christian's studies of carbohydrate and fat metabolism in the late 1930s, which laid the foundation for sports nutrition. Since then, science has contributed to knowing what to eat and drink before, during and after exertion, how to get the biggest bang for the buck from training, and how to refine the minutiae of technique in swimming that goes all the way down to positioning your fingers to get the most out of every stroke. It contributed to the evolution of better sporting equipment and clothes, such as suit elite swimmers wear to reduce water resistance. On the darker side, it equipped athletes with pharmacopoeia of illegal performance-enhancing drugs that increased oxygen to the blood and for endurance or boosted muscle strength for superhuman performance. When it comes to optimizing mental performance, sports science still has a long way to go, especially in a sport where the difference between winning and losing is measured in millimeters and milliseconds. We think potentially using 9 to 10% of the potential of the human brain, said Bertrand, if we can move that to 100%, it's a breakthrough. Elite level sports psychology doesn't advance via lab tests. Real science, often by trial and error, is happening out in the field, in the pool or on the track. Much is simply one-to-one experimentation by athletes and coaches, often drawing on life lessons learned elsewhere. A lot of what is needed isn't that arcane, whether they fully understood the science of what they were doing in Rio or not. The Americans did something right, the Australians didn't. The Campbell words choke is still in everyone's mind. When it comes to sports psychology, Bertrand knows what he's talking about. He sailed in 2 Olympics and several unsuccessful attempts to win the America's Cup before he became a national hero in 1983 as the skipper of the Australia 2, which broke the Americans' 132 stranglehold on the prestigious yachting event. While nautical engineering was wildly hailed as Australia's secret weapon in the victory, the wind keel of Australia 2 kept zealously showered. Bertrand says, It was the psychology that delivered the winning edge. Having competed in 2 Olympic Games and 5 America's Cup, it's obvious to me the psychology of performing when it really counts is a major area of opportunity, he says. We are in the business of endeavouring to understand what a super high performance team will look like for the Tokyo Olympics and to getting there faster than anyone else. Needless to say, Bertrand is not willing to spill the details of how he plans to choke-proof his athletes. But he's leaving no stone unturned in his quest for elite mental training techniques for Australian swim team. He is tapping into traditional mindfulness technique. See mindfulness sport in sport on page 52. We're page 47. Oh my God! In signature style, Bertrand style, he is also pushing the boundaries to discover the secrets of other elite performers. Oh my God! How do SAS commandos? You know, it's the separate things, SAS and commandos, a separate thing. Train their mental toughness for life or death missions. How do ballet dancers maintain their focus and technique while trying to please an audience? This is me off the side. What do elite teachers do when they have to try and train themselves up? That he was also aboard, brought aboard Walsh, whose methods in other sports have proven both exciting and unconventional, is another sign of pushing the sports psychology envelope. My good father. Walsh is something of a phenomenon in the realm of high-performance sports psychology. He has a PhD in applied biomechanics from Southern Cross University in New South Wales. He has specialised in optimising human performance. Now a full-time consultant, he has spent 8 years, 2009 to 2017, as the director of high performance at Red Bull, a major marketing player in extreme sports. Among other things, Walsh helped Felix Baumgartner prepare for his 2012 dive from a helium balloon at the edge of space, a feat that made the Austrian skydiver the first person to break the sound barrier without a vehicle. In his 22 years in the field, Walsh has worked with big wave surfers, mountaineers, corporate executives, surgeons, anyone trying to expand the boundaries of their abilities. He would he just took the number one cardiac surgery team in the world through a program, Walsh says, by way of example. His approach is grounded on the rite of passage ritual in ancient cultures, where young people face challenges designed to induce self-reflection and understanding. It's a very old tool which we are applying cutting-edge technology, he says, to understand more completely what actually happens. Oh, God, we have to do well in these games, don't we? Cognitive resources go into worrying about doing the task rather than performing it, says Harvey, who holds a master's degree in kinesiology and sports psychology. The goal for athletes to learn simply to do what they have spent years training themselves to do without too much self-scrutiny. Do or do not, there is no try, is how Falder Colby, a clinical psychologist and marathoner who died in 2017, liked to put it. The phrase comes from Star Wars Jedi Master Yoda. Trying is hard work that robs athletes of energy better spent in the simple act of racing, says Colby. Doing, on the other hand, is a state of mind in which focused action replaces fear and frazzle. A hollow mind is how Bertrand describes the ideal mental state. It all comes together in a rhythm. He recalls talking to Kathy Freeman after she won one of the most high-pressure races of all time, the 400-metre final in the 2000 Sydney Olympics, in which she carried the hopes of the entire nation. Bertrand asked her what had gone through her mind. Freeman told him about coming out the starting blocks perfectly, but her breathing being in harmony with her running as she entered the back straight, and about feeling no pain as she ran to the finish line. She didn't talk once about winning the medal. Bertrand said she talked about the wonderment of the process. This is the fundamental aspect of performing at your best, Bertrand says, where you're loving what you are doing and freeing your mind from the consequences of winning or losing. It's why sports psychologists often urge athletes to let go for the need to achieve a goal. Freeman's focus on the details of her running race and not on what the race meant, he says, epitomised the ideal of do not try. It is a peculiar type of focus. Normally, In flight or flight situation, evolution has conditioned us to focus goes down to tunnel vision, and you're aware of nothing other than the oncoming bear or decision to run like hell, Bertrand says. But in competition, more is needed. We also need to have peripheral vision away beyond this tunnel. Jeff Simmons, a professor of sports psychology in California State University, cites Davis Pliny, the second American cyclist to ever win a stage of the Tour de France. If there was a train wreck next to me on the course, Pliny told him, I would know there was a train wreck, but I wouldn't notice it because I just wouldn't care. Wow. When the athletes get this right, Bertrand says, everything starts to come down to slow motion, even through decisions and situations that are happening within microseconds. He experienced this during the history-making final race of the 1983 America's Cup, where he estimates he made 1,000 decisions, about one decision every 9 seconds, during the course of the 2.5-hour race. The challenge, of course, is working out how to achieve this elusive state of mind. Thousands of hours of practice play a role, but the pressure of competition is different to practice, which is where someone like Walsh comes in. Walsh's methods vary with the need of time commits of his climate, but putting people in an unfamiliar, stressful situation is at the core of his practice. Everyone gets stressed by whatever they fear or don't understand, he says. You identify these things and use them as training. At the opening reception for a conference, for example, he had participants wear masks and prohibited them from talking about themselves. It was probably the most awkward cocktail hour in history, until people adjusted and got to it, providing fodder for subsequent more serious discussions about handling stress. What this little exercise revealed is that the precise situation doesn't matter. What counts is people are pushed far enough out of their normal comfort zone. Public speaking, for example, is one of many people's greatest fears. So, Walsh. Okay. Walsh might challenge a client to perform stand-up comedy or improv. Someone without a specific fear might instead have to confront a box of snakes. Though controlled, such experiences can be powerful lessons. Stress inoculation is a military term. Yeah, you can bet. Walsh says, the key for the challenge to be scary but not so terrifying that one totally freezes up. There are more intense programs. In 2013, for example, Walsh collaborated with the US Navy SEALs to take Australian Ironman champ Matt Poole and three other elite athletes more at home in surf or white water on a 9-day mountaineering expedition to Chile and Patagonia. There they leaped across glacial crevasses, climbed treacherously unstable slopes, and bivouacked in snowstorms to ultimately summit a never-before-climbed Andean peak. Red Bull sponsored trip named Project Acheron after the first three rivers in hell in Dante's Inferno was documented in a 1-hour film. You can watch it online. Oh, wow. In it, Poole echoes Bertrand's belief that the great undiscovered territory for athletes remains the thing between your ears. Everyone does the work, the triathlete says. They're super fit, they're trained super hard. What makes the difference is the mental strength and ability to push even harder when you've got nothing else to give. Poole and his fellow adventurers went on without any other psychological coaching to a massive triumph in their chosen sports. Will Walsh sent the Australian swim team off to another similar adventure? No one knows, but it's the type of thing he does. So anyone on the swim team who doesn't like snakes or glaciers or possibly extended trek into the outback might be in for a surprise. There is a story Simon likes to tell about the Australian marathon runner Steve Montagani before the 1997 World Championships in Athens, which the sports psychologist got first hand from the runner. Montagetti was one of the great marathoners of his time, but never had earned a medal in the World Championships, nor did he run well in the heat. As the final drew near, it became clear the day would be hot. Worse, a motor scooter clipped and bruised his Achilles tendons a week before the race. But there he was at the final. So he began warming up routine, all the while feeling like crap. The race started and he was promptly left behind by the lead pack. So he figured he would aim to finish in the top 20 and got his rhythm. About a third of the way through the 420 kilometre 42-kilometre race, someone told him he was catching up. He kept on going. About 5 kilometres to go, he found himself fifth. He finished third at the bronze medal, which was only the one he's ever won the world championship in a long, illustrious career. He won on a crap day. To Simmons, it epitomised the hanging tough. He would say, it's more like I was just going to do it, which is exactly what Bertrand hopes his swimmers will do off the blocks in Tokyo 2020. If success follows, the acclaimed medals will deservedly go to athletes. But Bertrand Walsh had lost, had a host of others will have, but Bertrand Walsh and a host of others will have been behind the scenes working together to push the envelope for psychology to help each athlete in those few defining moments to master the space between their ears.